Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we advance peace, promote stability, and help you to think deterrence. This episode is part of our regular Deterrence Down Under series, focused on Australia and our deterrence challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Good day from Canberra. We hope you enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Dr. Carl Rhodes.
Hey, I'm Dr. Christine Leah.
And I'm Natalie Trelaw.
And as the Australian Triad, we'd like to welcome you to another episode of Deterrence Down Under with the National Institute of Deterrence Studies. So today we're going to talk about preparedness, transparency and acquisition, and the links to deterrence. Just a reminder that the views of our hosts today are their own and don't represent any institution with which we may be affiliated. So Christine and Natalie, two-thirds of the triad is going to be deployed to the United States. I'll use deployed in quotes here. You all are going to be at a conference about the time this comes out, right? So maybe you can tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. Carl, we are heading off. Well, I'm heading off to Kansas City first. But yes, Natalie and I will be heading up to Omaha, Nebraska for the Stratcom Deterrence Symposium. So we went last year and it was a lot of fun. We got to see some capability. And we're heading again this year. I hope folks will come and say hi. We'll be hanging out with Adam Lowther and Curtis McGiffin and from the NIDS View. Maybe Jim Petrosky will be there. We don't know yet. It's going to be fun. Yeah, come say hi.
Yeah, I'm super excited about the panel 3 discussion on beyond nuclear deterrence, the role of advanced non-nuclear capabilities in response to adversary threats. That one's going to be an exciting one.
That'd be a good one. Sounds exciting. And are you looking forward to eating Omaha steak there, Natalie? Are you
definitely
a steak eater?
No, yeah, I love my steak blood raw.
Oh, there we go. There we go. You're going to fit right in.
Yeah, I tend to gross people out with my steaks.
There we go.
I'll just terrorize them at the dinner table.
Fantastic. So we'll start off with a little bit of deterrence-related news here from Australia. First thing, in unmanned news, Australia is going to buy the U.S.-made Switchblade 300 loitering munition from manufacturer AeroVironment. This Switchblade 300, it's a tube-launched weapon, has a 1.7-kilogram warhead. It's got about a 30-kilometer range and can stay airborne for like 20 minutes. So the operator is flying that thing. They're getting back some imagery, EOIR, I believe. And the weapon itself actually has some autonomy to help identify the potential targets. Although my understanding is in the current version of the software, the human still needs to confirm the target. So it'll be interesting to see how Australia implements that system and the autonomy built into that system. But just a quick note that this is not really Australia's first buy of loitering munitions. Australia bought the AGM-142E to integrate on the F-111 back in the day, and that was a weapon where the operator steers it onto the target using EOIR guidance launched from an aircraft. Now, that thing never really got implemented. I understand there were some problems with implementation. But Defense also bought some Defentech D-40 munitions, which are loitering munitions to send to the Ukraine. So these things are, this was in 2022. The D-40s are basically a flying 40-millimeter grenade with a camera. But Defense here discovered that they hadn't been through all the necessary certifications for the fuse. And so Australia's Defense sent across the D-40s without the grenade, but luckily the UK stepped in and sent some of the lethal D-40s across to the Ukraine through a commercial buy. So they still ended up getting them. So interesting experience. There's still a lot to learn with these loitering munitions, and they will play a big role in any potential future conflict and are playing a big role today in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Over in cyber deterrence, Australia's taken the lead in a name and shame campaign, charging a China-backed group with conducting wide-scale cyber espionage. So the Australian Signals Directorate released a detailed report. It's marked as advanced complexity, so I couldn't quite get through the whole thing. It had a bunch of computer nerd stuff in there. But it's going to be useful to those interested in cyber tradecraft used by the APT, or Advanced Persistent Threat 40 group, that was working for the People's Republic of China Ministry of State Security. So the targets of that attack included lawmakers, academics, defense contractors. But the interesting thing for me was, you know, Australia took the lead on this. The investigation was conducted by the Five Eyes countries. Information came from Japan, South Korea, Germany, all working together as part of this investigation. But it is interesting that this is one of the few times where, you know, a state has been named as responsible for a cyber attack. So I don't know your thoughts, Christine, on cyber deterrence, if you've looked into that much. But, you know, it is a hard game because it's very difficult to point the finger at who the person responsible is, right?
Yeah. The whole realm around deterrence is interesting. The different different domains and how that's evolved over time. I'm an old school gal. I like my nukes as the ultimate deterrent. But I do acknowledge, of course, that cyber has a role to play in the deterrent space. I don't think it's a deterrent in and of itself, but contributes to a broader kind of package. The cyber one is interesting. If we're talking sort of in the allied space or allies and partners, I remember being at a war game. I won't say which one, but Australia was cooperating with an Asia Pacific partner, and we were talking about cyber, or proactive cyber, or I guess you call it offensive cyber versus defensive cyber. And there was, we were keen to cooperate with that partner, but the partner was also wary of sharing information, because whilst it is a useful domain, it's also it's one where you don't want to give away what you're capable of doing, which is an interesting paradox, I think.
Yeah, it's one of those challenging domains where exposing your capability means that the person you might direct those capabilities against or body can easily build defenses or more easily build defenses against it. And once you are aware of that capability, you can use it yourself. So it is a world of interesting types of deterrence. I'll put it that way. Maybe a discussion for later once we all get smarter on that topic. Lastly, the ADF has sent some assets over to RIMPAC 2024. This year, sent across 320 people, one warship, and one aircraft. That's about 80% smaller than Australia's contribution last time this game was held in 2022. The fact that only one Hobart, you know, guided missile destroyer was sent as compared to three surface ships and a sub in 2022 has kind of started alarm bells ringing about the availability of naval forces for near-term taskings. So last year, Australian government also turned down a U.S. request of please send a warship to join the International Task Force in the Red Sea. So this has led to real questions about the readiness of forces in the near term and sustainment. And so that kind of leads us to our first point of preparedness. So I'm going to let our listeners from America in on the super secret decoder ring for Australia, which is the word preparedness in Australia is what is called readiness in the U.S. military. So that's, you know, kind of the super secret squirrel decoder ring. So as we talk about preparedness here, our U.S. listeners can think about readiness. Yeah. So Christine, maybe you want to tell us about, you know, what preparedness means according to doctrine.
Yeah, no worries. Preparedness is a really interesting concept, and it's not one that's well understood in the academic literature, which, you know, is understandable because it's a military, but it's also an organizational concept that can be applied to different contexts. So here in Australia, preparedness is the combination of readiness and sustainment, and I have looked at readiness in the American context, but like we use the word preparedness here. And so I mean, 10 minutes is not enough to explain preparedness, but very quickly. So you have different levels of capability of the military and indeed of a department or of defense to complete different strategic tasks that are directed by higher ups. So, for example, defend the continental United States against a Russian nuclear attack. That is a strategic task. Or prepare to deploy troops to Europe in the event of a Russian attack on NATO. That is another strategic task. You can have all sorts of strategic tasks, but it depends on what a government wants. So you have, for example, these different levels of capability. So operational levels of capability, role-specific, in which force elements need to be certified so they can conduct missions at an acceptable level of risk. You have DLOC, directed level of capability, which is the lowest level of capability from which force elements can achieve all their operational levels of capability within designated preparedness requirement. And then you have minimum level of capability, which is the lowest level of trained capability, staffing, and equipment that will enable a force element to be able to perform an operational role. And look, these are not, you know, strictly defined, and they are relatively controversial and relatively challengeable. And for example, we have bouncing around the, the halls of Canberra, minimum viable capability, which is a term that has confused me, but is popular. And I think Natalie has some great perspective from her previous experience in industry on this. I wonder, can you please enlighten me what MVC means, Natalie?
So minimal viable capability is sort of a take on the minimal viable product. And minimal viable product is a version of a product early in the development process that has just enough functionality and features to test the product vision and gain feedback for future iterations. The minimum part of the MVP is especially critical. So it's not a fully featured product. It's just allowing you to test the basic concept. And Defence has taken this concept in order to provide the minimum level of capability. However, we might be faced with circumstances where you only have one shot. So if you need a force laydown that looks scary enough for a country to say, hey, not today, could you really have a minimum viable product? Or, you know, does your first force laydown really need to be, will minimum viable product really deter someone? And I think we need to think that through. It's also, not particularly useful for defining levels of preparedness as well, because you may need to go from, say, a humanitarian sort of crisis to having to mobilise your forces, and you need to have your spares and your fuel and whether or not you can mobilise your forces. So what does that look like? And is minimum viable product sufficient to define all of that?
Yeah, a really good question. I think one of the things that Australia has struggled with on the acquisition side is attempting to strive for the perfect, and the perfect is almost impossible to deliver and takes a long time. So I think they're trying to get around this issue, from my understanding, in terms of looking at this minimum viable capability as, can we get something on the ground and there rather than on PowerPoint charts? And something on the ground is obviously a better deterrent than a picture of a fancy system on PowerPoint charts that will arrive 10 or 20 years from now, if you're talking about fighting today. Also getting back to this naval sustainment issue, I mean, it isn't the first time that, you know, Navy potentially has had issues with sustaining, because when Ray Griggs took over as Chief of Navy in June 21, here's a quote that's taken from a recent ASPE report done by Andrew Davies on historical issues with sustainment of the Collins-class sub. Ray Griggs said, "I had no amphibious ships available. I had very poor availability of the submarine force. I had very poor availability of the patrol boat force. So I would say in the early part of my time as Chief of Navy was completely absorbed by dealing with those three issues." So sustainment and being ready to fight today is really important to deterrence, right? Because if your adversary knows, oh, all the ships are down for, you know, a problem with their propulsion system, then it opens a window of vulnerability and creates an issue there. And I was trying to think of, are there any historical examples where an adversary took advantage of this? And I could not come up with any. So, I mean, maybe one of our listeners will email us and tell us, you know, oh, this is a good example of that one. But, you know, it clearly creates a potential problem if your adversary knows these things, right?
Yeah, it's... I don't have a specific historical example of an adversary taking advantage of that, but certainly in looking at the history of arms control, I remember back in the sort of late 1800s, early 1900s, when, you know, European nations were thinking about arms control, one of the issues that came up was not only I can't point to a specific example, but like conceptually, I remember whilst the French and the Germans and the English were talking about concepts of maritime or naval power, and the relationship with land power, certainly it wasn't just a case of, oh, what do we have, but it was also like the production capacity of nations that was taken into account, and certainly the Weimar, the capacity of the German Weimar Republic to produce warships and land forces was taken into account in arms control negotiations. Like, well, you know, their industrial base is so much greater than ours, so therefore, you know, they could. This concept of latency, I think, as well. Like, this is not a term that's bandied around very much anymore, but we talk about nuclear latency, like the capacity of a country to produce nuclear weapons if it so desires. Well, that applies to the conventional realm as well. It's just that we haven't really thought about conventional forces that way. It's like, well, Australia has X amount of stuff, but how quickly could it produce more stuff? Yeah.
Really good question. And it applies to the cyber domain too, right, Natalie? I mean, this time to attribution matters, right?
Yeah, so I was going to bring up with your example in the introduction was, how does that impact your preparedness times as well? Or will, you know, you might be prepared to respond, but if you can't attribute it fast enough, then what sort of problems does that cause as well?
Yeah, exactly. In the United States, they think about this time to generate forces as part of the mobilization of the reserves, because in a major conflict, the United States will count upon, you know, the Air Force reserves, Army reserves, the National Guard. And so the time to bring those forces to bear and be ready to fight does count in terms of planning and is ever more important given the size of the threat. And, you know, Australia thinks about these things in terms of, you know, the broad topic of mobilization, probably something we could have talked about with Peter last episode. But, you know, there's a whole topic of mobilization and how Australia is able to respond to a threat in a timely fashion here. And, you know, they're thinking about things in terms of munitions manufacturing, right, Natalie?
Yeah, exactly. You know, like at the moment we're highly dependent upon the US, and we've got to get those weapons from the US across. And at the moment we're seeing, you know, the drain on the NATO's weapon systems and the US systems as well. So if we have to, if the world or if more events happen or crises happen in the world, you know, how does that impact Australia's sort of preparedness as well going forward?
Certainly. And it was interesting. I was reading an op-ed, it was a few weeks ago, and I can't remember what it was called, but Bridge Colby was saying, well, you know, the naval shipyard issues, you know, it would be great to supply Australia with certain platforms and capabilities, but, you know, when a certain substance hits the fan, America has to look after itself first. It's like, well, that's fair. But it is interesting, you know, the interconnectedness of global weapons industry, but also, indeed, the preparedness implications and sovereignty and Australia having its own stuff. It's all really interesting, and it is. A lot of people like to refer to the Commonwealth War Book from 1901, I think it was. I can't remember. but having, like, Australia did used to have a great independent sovereign industrial base, and we don't have it anymore. And it's a conundrum.
Yeah. Mike Pezzullo's made some reference to that, you know, war book a few times in op-eds or recent speeches. But, you know, this whole question of also the U.S. shipbuilding issues leads us to kind of our last topic, which is transparency and accountability in acquisition. And the United States has been quite transparent about problems in its shipbuilding area. So, I mean, here in Australia, we're obviously watching the Virginia-class acquisition extremely closely. Like, if someone drops a bolt on the assembly line, we're probably, you know, paying attention to that here. But, you know, this whole idea of how quickly can the Virginia-class get off, you know, be built and get off the line. What are the sustainment issues the United States is facing in terms of sustaining those Virginia class? Because all that will transition over here. So having that, you know, kind of transparency around those issues and what's happening there is helpful as Australia thinks about these things and plans for the future. But thinking about transparency and accountability, I thought it might be useful just to, for both the Australian and U.S. listeners here, to kind of describe what happens in the U.S. when a program goes, I'll say, off the rails in terms of acquisition versus what happens in Australia. So the U.S., a good example, and this hits to the heart of deterrence people, is the Sentinel program, the new ICBM. Just went through a Nunn-McCurdy breach. So that's a 1983 statute in the U.S. that defense programs that have costs exceeding 25% of their original estimate have to be certified as critical to national security or discontinued, and typically they also get restructured at that point. So this Sentinel ICBM was just recently recertified after it had an 81% cost growth at Milestone B. I mean, that's not a small number. And Christine, yeah, I can see you gasping over there. So first of all, look, there is a process to deal with this. There is an accountability process and put into place by these senators who were thinking ahead about how do we deal with these problems and how do we help, you know, reduce them. And part of that is transparency. If there is a cost growth and a lot more money that needs to be spent, you need to make it obvious because the taxpayers are paying for these things and, you know, want to have a product delivered at the end, be it minimum viable product or a very viable product. The next piece is Colonel Charles Clegg, who was in charge of the Sentinel program, was recently let go. Now, they didn't say it was because of the cost growth, but it was because, quote, he did not follow organizational procedures, and the service lost confidence in his ability to lead the program. So, you know, look, there may be some linkage there, but there was accountability in that case, in that this program went off the rails, partially, it sounds like, because of his decisions, and so he was let go. So that leads to, you know, how does Australia deal with these things, right? And we have an ANAO here, and they do reports on, you know, major programs at, you know, yearly intervals about how major programs are doing. And that was typically a place where you learn about some problems with, you know, programs. But over time, defense has limited the amount of information that they provided to the ANAO. And in the most recent report that was released in February 24, 9 of the 20 major products did not provide a final operational capability forecast date, which means we don't know when those things are going to be done as taxpayers here. And, you know, the result, according to the ANAO, the Australian National Audit Office, is that the report, quote, provides a reduced level of transparency and accountability to Parliament and other stakeholders. So, I mean, this leads to the question of, you know, does this kind of transparency about when these programs are showing up help or hurt Australia's security in the long run? It's a really open question, because one could probably guess that if the date is not published, it's not going to be showing up early, right? So, you know, Christine or Natalie, I appreciate your thoughts on this because this is, in my opinion, something very important. Christine, fire it up.
Yeah, I remember, so I'm certainly not an expert on defense costing and budgeting and so forth, but I do remember a long time ago I participated in the summer workshop on the analysis of military operations and strategy, SWAMOS, run by Cornell and Columbia Universities. And we had a guest speaker. I can't remember his name, but he was so smart. He was from, what's the US agency that like oversees transparency with defense budgeting, the AGO? I can't remember.
There's the GAO, the General Accountability Office, I believe is the acronym, although I always get it wrong.
I think it was that. We had a speaker. I feel like an idiot. I forget his name. But he's a fellow at CSBA, the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And he gave us a lecture, and he, you know, he gave us the tools and so forth. And he said, oh, okay, well, now that you know these things, try and cost this program. And everyone had a different answer. And it's really interesting how – I'm being a theory nerd here. How do you cost a – program or a capability or a project? Like, how do you think about costing something, and how do you project costing? And I'm just wondering, like 81%, that's a huge blowout in terms of budgeting. But I wonder, the Nunn-McCurdy Act, if it was designed or conceived of in an era where defense costing was easier to do. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So if you look, I'm not prepared to talk about all the details, and you know, but I do understand that they took a few shortcuts because the program was the Minuteman it needed to replace was running out, and to do all the necessary costing to the level of detail needed was going to delay the program. And they thought with digital engineering, they'd be able to move quickly with that program. But, you know, I don't want to get in that because there's probably some experts on our podcast who know far more about this than we do. It is an important point. And the question of cost estimation and who does it? Is it an inside the government job? Is it an independent assessor that's outside of government doing cost estimation? Especially here with the government trying to move away from having any contractors on the books in defense and across government. You know, there are some roles for independent outside of government, you know, organizations to help out with these things. It's an open question as to who does this. But Natalie's got a point too about, you know, there's other things we need to look at here, right?
Yeah, so one of the deficiencies with our current reporting is that we only look at the biggest budget items. We don't look at those projects that may be not the top 20 budget items. So, you know, do you have the Jesus nut or the silver bullet sitting somewhere down there in one of the smaller programs, whether that be tires on a plane or fuel on a jet or a new weapon system, like an upgrade to a bomb or something, for example, or a missile. It could be somewhere sitting down there and it's being overlooked, and that could be, you know, the minimum viable capability that you need.
Yeah, it's 100% true. Like, it could be that rack that carries a specific bomb, you know, or something like that, that really matters quite a bit.
Yeah, or like the slicker man on your Virginias. Just kidding.
There we go. Exactly right. Last bit in corruption news, I'm going to bring us back to the news. According to the national broadcaster ABC, the Auditor General revealed that a defense employee gave confidential information to Talos Corporation, a foreign-owned defense contractor, and then solicited a bottle of champagne ahead of a $1 billion munitions deal. And then after that, not only that, he joined that defense business after it was awarded the lucrative contract. So this is a case where this person was not named. Like, there have been examples of corruption in the U.S. with high-level Air Force acquisition people that went to defense contractors. They were named and sentenced. You know, this gets back to a different kind of deterrence. We're going to round it all the way back to deterrence, which is, how do you deter bad behavior in the ADF and defense? How do you do that, which is, you know, publicly name people and, you know, punish them to stop other people from committing the same crimes or problems. You know, that's kind of my thoughts. Corruption happens everywhere. It's how do you get to that cycle of continual improvement so you weed out the corruption? How do you get to that cycle of continual improvement so you weed out the bad programs and learn something from them? That's the important part, in my opinion. So, any thoughts?
Well, you know, annual mandatory training, Carl.
Yeah, if you watch those PowerPoint slides enough, you won't do it, right?
You'll be dead by the time you're through them.
Exactly. I think we're running out of time for today. A really good discussion around transparency and acquisition preparedness and the important links to deterrence from an Australian context. If you're headed to the StratCom conference in Omaha, about the same time this episode comes out, be sure to say hi to Christine and Natalie. They'll be there. If you're really nice to Christine, she might give you a deterrence down under pin even. So thanks for listening, and remember to always think deterrence. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Deterrence Down Under. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.